Because when I go to a birth or I go to a death, it's roughly the same experience for me. It's where the form and the formless, it's right at the edge of the lake of the formless. I just... I'm carrying all these stories in my mind. We're still with Maharaji. I just finished a book, or I sent the manuscript in. It's a really good book. It is. I really like it. It's my 11th book. And it's called Aging Lightly, A Spiritual Paradigm for Conscious Aging. Because the baby boomers start to turn 50. It was interesting, when I was 60, and I turned 60, I thought, well, in the Hindu tradition, there are the stages of life, and when you hit 60, you're supposed to let go of everything and be free. So I better gear down. So for about 6 months, I tried to be 60, but it was a real drag. I didn't want to be. So I decided not to be, so I forgot about the whole thing. I just went galumphing along in my nondescript age. And then when I was 62, I was in Westport, Connecticut in autumn. We had been out with the autumn leaves, and I took the late evening train back where the station's closed, so you buy the ticket on the train. The conductor came through the dimly lit coach, and I was just delighting in the day that I've just been through. And the man said, tickets, and I said, I'll have to buy my ticket here in the train. He said, which kind do you want? And I said, do I have a choice? And he said, regular or senior? Now, the lighting was bad, but... So I found myself, it was very far out, because what I found myself saying was, senior? Meaning, I'll have a senior ticket, but I was as a question. I reminded me of when I was 18 years old and I went into a bar in New York State for my first beer. Beer? You know, like, are you going to give me a beer? And this conductor didn't ask for identification or anything. I mean, he just gave me the senior ticket. I said, how much is the senior ticket? He said, $4.50. And how much is the regular ticket? $7. Uh-huh. This is a good scam, whatever. So he walked away, and I sat there, and I realized I am a senior citizen. I mean, what I just bought with that ticket was a whole thing, you know? I mean, it was not nothing. And what it felt like, the funny thing it felt like was, this is this wonderful old story my father told that I'm sure any of you that have ever heard me have heard the story probably. It's about Zumbach the tailor. That there was a man in a small village, and he did very well in life, and he decided to have a really good suit made. So he went to Zumbach, who was reputed to be the best tailor in the whole area. So he went in for the final fitting, and he put on the suit, and this sleeve was like almost 2 inches longer than this sleeve. So the man said, Zumbach, it should be done with a Yiddish accent, I mean, to pass it on traditionally. I'm just, as a storyteller, Zumbach. That's enough, see, just a little bit. Zumbach, I don't mean to complain, but this sleeve is almost 2 inches longer than this sleeve. Zumbach drew himself up to his full 5'4" being and said, there is nothing wrong with the suit. It's the way you're standing. And he took the guy's shoulder and pushed it down. So the man's shoulder was like this, but the suit fit much better. And then the man looked, and there was this material bundled up behind the head, and he said, Zumbach, he said, my wife hates it when there's material like that. Could you just take that out? There's nothing wrong with the suit. It's the way you're standing. And he pushes the man's head down. And now in the mirror, the suit fits exquisitely. So the man wears it home. And so he's at the bus stop, and somebody comes up and takes a lapel and feels, what a beautiful suit. I bet Zumbach the Tailor made that suit. How did you know? Because only somebody as skilled as Zumbach could fit somebody with a body as crippled as yours. And that's what I felt like I had just put on Zumbach's suit, you know. I'm a senior citizen, you know. There was just a great moment in this campaign between Frick and Frack, and in which presidential candidate Dole was asked whether he wore shorts or briefs. And he said, depends. That's nonpartisan humor. That's just, I mean, that's just essence humor. So when I came back from being with Maharaji, I then figured I'll stay in as tight as I can to do all my practices as rigorously as I can so I can transform myself. And I was now a Raja Yogi and doing long fasts and breath control, pranayama, and so on. And I was really out there. I mean, I was really high. I weighed 140 pounds then. 6'2". I looked like I had just come out of the camps. And that was yogi look. It was a great moment when I was in India and I got so high that I had it looked like a light coming out of my forehead. And you could see it in the mirror. I mean, I could see it in the mirror. So I had to go to New Delhi, leave the temple to go to New Delhi to get my visa extended. And I arrive, I take on New Delhi. I haven't been out of the temple for months, silent, doing yoga. And I walk into New Delhi Connaught Circus barefoot, with beads all here and a long beard, and I'm wearing an alfi, which is like a dress, and I've got long hair then, and I've got my jola, this, and I walk in to a stationery store and I'll go for some envelopes, and then I say, how much are they? And I reach to get my money, and the man says, oh no, I couldn't take money from a saint like you. I thought, I think I found my career. And I had. And so can you. Everybody's welcome to play. So I did all my practices, but what I found myself becoming was, the crudest way of saying it, was like a horny celibate. You know, I was busy not being something and getting very high from it. And I saw that that was not freedom. That just wasn't freedom. And that if I were going to be free, I heard in Buddhist instructions, the mind cannot cling to those things with attraction or aversion. You don't deny the thing, you don't even deny the feelings, you don't identify with the attraction or the aversion. And I saw how I was identified with the aversion to the world I lived in, to the culture I had been acculturated into. I was struggling to come up for air out of my own acculturation. And I still was frightened of getting trapped back in again. So I had this aversion. Makes perfect sense to me. And I realized that that wasn't good enough. And so I turned around and realized that living life was going to be my vehicle to becoming free. Not pushing it away, but embracing it. And when I turned around and looked at what was, from the degree of quietness of my mind, I was absolutely overwhelmed by the immensity of the suffering. And it wasn't a downer. I mean, it wasn't a bad trip type thing. It was just seeing the way in which the containers were contracted things. I mean, I saw all the suffering that we see every day on television. But then I saw that in the people who were in People magazine as the people who were winning, if you looked at the musculature of the face and if you looked into their hearts at all, there was such pain. There was such pain. And I kept wondering whether that was like part and parcel of incarnation. And could I bear it? Because most of us don't bear it. We say it would be unbearable to stay open to the immensity of the suffering. How are you going to feel for a child who was raped or murdered? When are you going to have enough time to grieve that one? But what I realized at that point, that the statement, that's unbearable, you've got two choices. One is look away, turn it off one way or another, abstract intellectualize about it, or hold a belief about it, or deny it, don't even see it. Or, if it is unbearable, that first way is changing what's out there. The other is change what's in here. That is, the person who finds it unbearable has to go. Because there is a part of us for which that is bearable. And acknowledging that part of us for which that's bearable does not negate the pain in our human hearts that attends our being in the presence of such suffering. People say to me, are you happy these days? And I say, yes, I am. I'm very happy. And they say, oh, that's good. Somebody else says, are you sad these days? I say, yeah, I'm sad. That was a big one to find out. Because I grew up in a world where in order to be happy, you had to make believe you weren't sad. And it was a great relief to understand that all the emotions are present in every moment. And somehow they're present in their unmanifest or imminent form. And what comes into form at any moment is something that awakens grief or pain or joy or preciousness or fun or humor or, and you're just dancing through all the forms of life. And what I saw was that as long as I had aversions, I couldn't be free, and until I could be free, I couldn't free anybody else. Because when you look around and you see somebody suffering, your heart, you would like to do something to relieve their suffering. And you begin to see that not only is it what you do, but it's who does it and how you do it as to whether you exacerbate their suffering or end it. I can walk into a room with somebody with some incredible illness. And I can feel so badly for that person that I can never escape from that. And all they get from the mirror of my mind is an image of themselves as somebody to be felt badly for. I walk into a room with somebody with advanced AIDS symptoms, many opportunistic illnesses, social ostracism, economic hardship, loss of dreams, youth, everything. And the heart breaks, and the empathy goes out to this fellow human being. And as I sit there, I start in doing my inner practices, turning the channels until I am resting as a soul who has taken birth. I am a somebody who is here to visit somebody who's sick and to be with them. And I am a soul doing that. And I am seeing another soul who is busy having AIDS. And suddenly my consciousness is available to that other person on both levels. There's a woman I went to visit, a lovely Quaker lady that was dying of cancer. And she was very close to death, and I came in and she took the oxygen away from her mouth. She said, I'd never met her before, and she said, sit down here. She said, Ram Dass, I want you to help me die. I'm so bored. So I thought about that. You know, that's quite an opening gambit. I thought about it. I said to her, you know, I'd be bored too if I were busy dying all the time. Couldn't you die like 10 minutes an hour? See, the thing is, when you're dying, everybody, oh, you're dying. Here, you're dying, you're dying. Yeah, I'm in here. No, you're dying, you know. I said, let's do it together. And we held hands and I said, do you hear the children outside? Feel the counterpane under your fingertips? Clock on the mantelpiece. Feel a breeze on our cheeks. We just slowly, slowly just went into the moment. And it was enough for both of us. And she said, thanks. And I left. And she died. It's interesting to realize that as you acknowledge that you exist on more than one plane of consciousness, and you start to see that that's what this journey is about transformation, is learning not to put down life, but to delight in life because you're not trapped in it. You are not exclusively your ego. You are also your soul. And the qualities of the soul is it doesn't live in the same time that ego lives in. It doesn't live in the same fear of death that ego is. Ego fears death because when death comes, ego goes. Soul says, ah, there goes ego. And you can see how in some cultures, like in India, when they talk about dying, they call it dropping the body. Now, who the hell's dropping the body? The body dropping itself? What is this? See, even the language they're using is helping them acknowledge a plane of consciousness in themselves. So what we've got to see is that the language we use and the culture we're living in treats a certain part of us as real and treats other parts of us as unreal. And our job is to extricate ourselves from that without putting it down, but be, as Christ said, in the world but not of the world. Of getting those two levels going simultaneously. And what I saw in the aging book was, and after the train trip in Westport, that the mythology of aging in this culture, well, I'll tell you, it's a great culture to visit, but I'd hate to grow old here. It's not a very warm and cuddly culture to grow old in. And that's really interesting. Because the mark of a really advanced culture is that, I mean, it honors every stage of life. And because we are so non-traditional and we are so enamored of technology and its products and all of that, we deal with aging as obsolescence. So you become irrelevant. So while in traditional societies, when you get old, like I went to India maybe 8 years ago or so, and I was gray, and I went to the village I spent a lot of time in, and a friend came up to me, he said, Ram Dass, you're looking much older. Now, I heard it from this culture's point of view, thinking, oh my God, I got to get more sun or something, you know. Then I heard the tone he was saying it in. He was saying it with respect. Like, you finished with that, now you can really be, oh. Isn't that interesting? So I started to see that if I weren't vigilant, I was going to slide down the whole cultural model of what aging was like. Because I watched, like I, in my zeal to be young, I did in my shoulder. Straight ego. And the result was that I had to have surgery. And after I fell down and hurt my shoulder, I was amazed at how much the people around me started to infantilize me. I mean, in the most gentle and kind ways, you know? Oh, be careful. Oh, ooh, here, let me. Oh. And I saw that I could get sucked in by that. And pretty soon, you know, would you get me that glass? Now, I don't question that with age, energy changes and facility and skills and all motor capacity, all of it changes. And there are times where it's great to have somebody get it, but I'd like to not just buy in because of a cultural conspiracy to define what reality is, especially when it's, we are living in a youth-oriented culture in which we are focused on knowledge rather than wisdom. So what we call our wise people are really knowledgeable people. They're very smart. You know, people like the guy that runs Nightline. You know, they're our elders. You feel you can really trust them. Sure. Just got to follow the bread chain back one link. We are all feeding a conspiracy of reality to one another all the time, and we tune in 6 hours a day, the general public, to make sure we get our good taste of acculturation. Now, what's happened is interesting. And while... Oh, it's 20 minutes of 8. Now, we start at 6:30, so it's an hour, and then we go to... Okay. I want to leave plenty of time for questions, but I love hearing myself talk. In the 60s, it wasn't just created then, I mean it had been building all the time, but something did happen. The confluence of so many different forces, because there was some kind of awakening that occurred that fed civil liberties, civil rights issues. It fed the anti-Vietnam movement. It fed sexual freedom. It fed women's liberation. It fed environmental consciousness. It fed on and on. And what happened then was that through some concatenation of planets or whatever it is that you think does whatever it does, there were enough people, and then the rock and roll minstrels carried it forth to generations throughout the world through their lyrics and music, opening the heart and then pouring in other paradigms of reality. Whatever that happened, it was like an explosion. It was basically a shift from absolute to relative reality. It was going from Newtonian to Einsteinian physics. It was realizing that all the institutions, these kind of monolithic, vertical, patriarchal social structures, were all the creation of mind. They were like paper tigers. And that's not pejorative. It is just seeing that we got trapped in the illusions created by our own minds. There was a great moment when a lot of hippies surrounded the Pentagon and held hands and chanted Om to rise the Pentagon. I am told that only a few people actually saw it rise. But that really wasn't the point. The point was that they were saying the Pentagon is just another thing instead of the Pentagon. And that undercutting that allowed a tremendous empowerment of people that were being persecuted or oppressed, but it was basically also an empowerment of the individual. And we took that and ran with it. And we assumed, since what we had touched through whatever means we touched it at that moment and through a collective thing that allowed lots of people to touch it, we assumed, because it felt so true to us, just like what I said about at Harvard, what happened to me, that everybody would soon see the obviousness of it all. But what did happen was that those of us who tasted of relative reality and then took it into whatever domain we took it, whether it was social action or inner spiritual work or whatever, scared the hell out of the people who didn't. Really. And what they experienced was the potential of anarchy and chaos. And they wanted order because they felt safe. They felt they had created an order which was safe, and they were frightened of death. And therefore, they wanted the structure in place. And that whole consciousness was threatening that structure. And I would say that the naivete that we experienced, along with our innocence. We were innocent, but we were also naive because we were busy being innocent. So we didn't hear the whole thing. We polarized the whole scene. That those of us that changed scared people, and we forced the pendulum swing that has been going on in this country ever since, which is fundamentalism, and it's the really conservative right, and it's the seesawing effect that we're all playing. It's not liberal and conservative. That isn't the way it is anymore. Really, the interesting game is the game of consciousness. It's no longer the political arena. I mean, Bob Dole and Bill Clinton are both well-meaning people. They're not mean, vicious, horrible people. Whatever crap they've done that is human. But they are really not very consciously playing their games. And I think Bill Clinton is a Rhodes Scholar. I think he's smart as hell. And I think that's how far smart gets you. Which is good, but it isn't interesting enough. When my guru wanted to put somebody down, he called them clever. When he wanted to reward them, he'd say, how simple you are. Good teachings, aren't they? Yeah. See, I don't think that the game of politics any longer, because of the information age and the multinationals, the whole game is. And it's just extraordinary how quickly the collective consciousness is wrestling with changes in time and space and the way it deals with each other and all of it. It's as fast as your consciousness can go just to open to it. I see what is changing is the fact that more and more conditions are ripe to support people acknowledging in themselves more than one plane of consciousness and beginning to meet in that place, saying, are you here? I'm here. Look at this crap. Look at what we have created. Look at this mess. Look what we bought into. Look how our fear motivated us to create institutions that are strangling us. And we did it. It's not them. We are them. You know, we met the enemy and it's us. I did two books called How Can I Help with Paul Gorman, which is really Lovely book. I really like it. And Compassion in Action with Mirabai Boyce. In both of them, I was plotting the process of consciousness. Because when you go into nobody training, meaning you're extricating your awareness from identification with your somebodyness. That's what it means. You're breaking an identification. You're not denying anything. You're just breaking one link. What happens is that your awareness starts to be in the universe in a way that's different than it was when you were busy holding it inside you. It's like you know the world subjectively instead of objectively. You know the world from inside yourself rather than as object. Like if you're in your thinking mind, you say, well, I'll think this through. The thinking mind thinks about things. So when you're thinking about yourself, you have become a thing you're thinking about. I mean, I'm playing a lot of, I'm just passing this by. You can skip it if you want. But what the if you look at that predicament of being trapped in your mind, which is a big yes in our culture, you will see that you're always one thought away from where the action is. And you're starving. Can you imagine? You're right there where you're in Disneyland all the time and you don't have a ticket or something. You can't get through. You're in a wall created by your own mind. So you're always, how interesting. You're always trapped in being the experiencer while the experience goes untasted. So what we're talking about is the loosening of that barrier, the dissolving of the boundary between experiencer and experience. Rumi says, if the taste is bitter, become the wine. Great line. What these books are about is the process of extricating your awareness from the entrapment of your separateness exclusively. You're still separate, but you're also not separate. So you experience the world a different way. So while in your separateness, if you are in pain, that is her suffering or his suffering. If I flip the dial to the soul level, it's our suffering. Okay? Thich Nhat Hanh talks about it as interbeing. It's our suffering. If I flip the dial again, it's my suffering. There's only one of it. And at that point, the my and other cease to be relevant. They don't define anything. So at that point, there is the suffering. And the suffering is the same as if you had a splinter in this finger, and this finger pulled out the splinter. This finger doesn't turn to this finger and say, hey, thanks. I'm really eternally have gratitude for this. Because they're both part of the same body. There's compassion. Compassion comes out of emptiness. It comes out of the fact that there aren't two. So that the suffering awakens the compassion. And so if I respond to your suffering with a compassionate act and you say thank you, that isn't the level at which it's happening. I can rip it off and say you're welcome. Is this too weird still here? You're not. Okay, it's time for questions. I can see that. Because this goes on and on all night if you don't watch it. I'll tell you what we'll do just to make it comfortable. You want to take a stretch for about 3 or 4 minutes? And then those of you that want to get out can do so without any embarrassment. And the rest, we'll have some questions and answers. Take about a 5-minute break.